Hello, y'all! This is Scott Merritt from Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach. Welcome to another Snacks for the Brain! Now let's get down to business. Today I interviewed exciting, energetic, and inspirational astronomer Dr. Kevan Stassen about his work, about his dedication to seeing that minority populations are represented in the sciences and especially in astronomy, and about what got him into science in the first place. As a child, it seems he was told he was good at science. What on earth, or in space, does that mean? Listen up, episode 16 of Snacks for the Brain! Your work is in the field of star life cycles?
Star formation, really. Mm-hmm. The stellar birth part of the stellar life cycle, primarily, yeah.
Neat. So, and you're also very much involved in making sure that minorities are represented in physics and astronomy, and I'd like to hear more about that.
The context is that even though astronomy is perhaps, I would argue, one of the most exciting of the sciences, and so you might therefore think that we would have no trouble recruiting talent from the full spectrum of potential future scientists and explorers, the fact is that astronomy remains one of the least representative of the sciences in terms of the makeup of its practitioners. And so one of my long time interests and passions, largely for personal reasons, has been to do what I can to make sure that we take advantage and tap into the full pool of available talent in the United States for science and engineering generally, but for astronomy specifically. And so I've been working to develop a number of programs at basically all levels in the educational pipeline to try to do something about this problem. And so the Scopes for Schools program, for example, is one example. The Scopes for Schools program is a program where we work primarily with teachers at the K-12 level, science teachers at the K-12 level, to do a bit of professional development, a bit of content knowledge development in astronomy, space science, earth science.
Right, that's kind of right up our alley at the Center for Science Outreach. Mm-hmm. Too. And as a teacher in the elementary setting, I know firsthand that a lot of, especially early elementary and elementary level teachers, are sort of expected to be experts in everything. You know, if they've got a self-contained classroom, they may be needing to teach science, teach space, but may not really have the background to do it, so you're providing a valuable service there.
Well, and kids are so universally responsive to the subject of outer space and of astronomy, you know, really at all age levels. But, you know, one of the things that we have been learning from research that's been done over the past couple of decades that compares grade school students in the United States to their counterparts in other first world nations around the world, is that our kids start out very competitive, in fact, by many measures, in the lead when they're very young, and that lead begins to slip more and more as they get older. And it seems to be that there's something about the way that we teach science in this country when kids are very young that is very right. Something about the very discovery-oriented nature of how we teach science when kids are in second grade.
Absolutely.
Really taps into the way that kids want to and most naturally are able to learn. And we increasingly do something less and less right. And that of course, is not to impugn the teachers who have the courage to get up every day and teach those kids who increasingly become harder and harder to teach. But one of the things we've been trying to do with Scopes for Schools is to empower teachers at the middle and high school levels with some content, with some pedagogy, and most importantly, with some tools and resources to be able to maintain that discovery-oriented approach to learning when the kids seem to need it most.
Yeah, the pedagogical approach seems to really shift in middle school and high school in most settings, especially in today's age of teaching to the test, when you know the huge accountability issue is so important, that You know, teachers often feel they don't have time for inquiry-based learning. So
yeah.
How would you respond to that?
I started the Sculpts for Schools program when I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And one of the teachers that I worked with then, if I remember correctly, said this wonderful thing about teaching to the test versus discovery-oriented teaching and learning. And he said, Wisconsin is traditionally a farming state, and he said, there's this great farming expression, which is that you don't fatten a pig by weighing it. And obviously testing and accountability has its place, but those ought to be separate questions from how one ideally would conduct pedagogy. And too often I think we confuse theories of testing with theories of pedagogy.
Thank you, very nicely put.
And so we really try to bring that, back squarely within the realm of how do we tap into the kids' natural curiosity for the universe and their penchant for learning actively, and do that in a way that provides teachers with the resources they need to do that. So we build telescopes with teachers and their kids. These then become telescopes that the teachers get to keep and use in their classrooms. We provide curriculum activities and ongoing connection with professional scientists and amateur astronomers, and really try to sort of do the village approach to teaching the kids astronomy.
That's wonderful. And you're also doing presentations through the Center for Science Outreach on over video conferencing to schools, and I hope that you keep that up. You do a little Wonder Bread sort of presentation.
Maybe. Yes, that's right.
And all that has to do with the density of stars, is that?
Well, it's really an opportunity to sort of talk about the life cycles of stars, mm-hmm. within which, for some stars anyway, the end of the life cycle, the end of the story, is a state of matter which is peculiar and sort of fantastical and interesting, which is that when very massive stars die, they can leave behind a corpse that we call a neutron star, and a neutron star represents the densest state of matter that exists in nature. And so in telling that story, I end by having the kids, by presenting them with the challenge of taking a slice of bread and then I also give them a sugar cube, and the challenge is to squeeze down, to compress the bread to the size of the sugar cube if they can, and it turns out to be basically impossible, which is great fun because the kids, smushing up bread and making a big mess. But to compare that challenge with the fact that one sugar cube-sized chunk of a neutron star weighs more than all the people who have ever lived, ever, And so then the kids...
staggering to imagine.
Start to imagine, squishing all of humanity to the size of a sugar cube, and so that's kind of fun, too. But, just sort of tapping into that that imagination and creativity the kids have to incite their wonder and interest, yeah.
Fantastic.
At the risk of going a wee bit long with the snacks for the brain, I like to keep them to about 10 minutes. I would like to continue and finish this little interview with Dr. Kayvon Stassen because he has some marvelous, 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 marvelous things to say about how he got into science in the first place. Listen up!
Your name, Kayvon, means in Iranian?
It's an old Persian name. Mm-hmm. It was the name of one of the Persian emperors, and Kayvon means Saturn.
Mm-hmm. And Stassen is a German name for your stepfather.
That's right. My stepfather is German, and Stassen is his name, and I took his name when my mother married him when I was very young. And then my middle name, Guadalupe, is my maternal grandmother's name.
Whoa, that's a multicultural name.
So, yeah.
Can you say it all?
It's all in there. Kayvon Guadalupe Stassen, yeah.
Very nice.
That's right.
Do you think that the fact that you were named for a planet had something to do with you getting into science and astronomy in the first place?
It's fun to think about that, though that would certainly be a pseudo-scientific belief.
Predestination.
That's right. I actually didn't learn the meaning of my name until I was an adult and had already decided to become an astronomer.
So what drew you into the sciences?
Well, I always I'll tell you why I'm hesitating. I was about to say that I always knew that I had an aptitude for science, and actually that's an interesting thing to say in and of itself. I've thought about this. You know, I was always told that I had an aptitude for science, and what's interesting about that is that I actually had no clue what science was until I had fully signed on. You know, I was always told that I was good at science. What does that really mean? What it meant was that I was good at, you know, learning the mathematical algorithms and learning the tricks for solving different kinds of math problems. It meant that I was good at memorizing, I don't know, Avogadro's number. You know, and certainly I had a natural fascination. I think that at some level you have to have a natural fascination to get you through the lean years when being good at science means memorizing encyclopedic volumes of scientific information, you know.
Very good advice for young scientists, I think.
Because the fact is that, you know, between when, you know, we got to put grass seeds in a sponge in second grade and watch, you know, an orange rot on the windowsill and just kind of see what happens and the mold grow and all that stuff, between then and when I started doing experiments again for real as a graduate student, you know, that's a long time between second grade and grad school when you don't actually get to do science.
So in a sense you're trying to get even with all those teachers who led you through all
No, certainly not try to get even with the teachers, but, you know, I have had to, now that I'm a teacher myself, right? I mean, certainly not as skilled or as committed a teacher as my middle and high school counterparts, but now that I'm a teacher of science myself at the university level, I've had to come to grips with the fact that we teach about science, we teach the outcome of what scientists do, but so rarely do we give kids the opportunity to experience what science is, the discovery nature of it, the excitement that comes from figuring out what the questions are and how to design and conduct an experiment, and the thrill that comes from that process. And so what did it mean that I was good at science? Well, you know, for so long, you know, I'm glad I was told that because it fueled me and it sustained me. But it wasn't until I was a graduate student and I had fully signed on to become a scientist that I realized, you know, I had no idea what science was all about.
But you are now one of those people who enjoys coming to work. Is that true? An accurate description?
You know, you asked about sort of my background. You know, my mother, who is, I think I can safely say by all counts, the most courageous person that I know. You know, she walked across the desert so that I could be born an American citizen and so that I could have opportunities that she could only dream of. You know, she all my life basically insisted that I take every opportunity to, you know, to excel and to succeed and to live a full life. And so I can say with confidence and with pride when she now asks, "Are you happy?" I can say with full confidence that I love what I do.
Wow.
And that is not only you know, a thrill to be able to say for myself, ultimately I have to, you know, account for myself, but it's also gratifying to be able to account for her and for all the sacrifices and an effort that she made to give me the opportunities that I have.
Very
to
nice.
Be able to say I really love my job.
That's it for Snacks for the Brain, episode 16. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again. For more information, visit www.vanderbilt.edu/CSO for the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach.